And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's Veterans Day, November 11th, where everybody talks about how they love the veterans. The rest of the year, they could care less about the veterans. I have had an issue that I've gone to every official trying to get assistance, and they just blow me off. It's public corruption. Even our local congresswoman, who I helped get elected when she ran her first time, talked about her on my show, pushed her. She got elected. I ain't got time for me. I got an email from her today about all the wonderful things she's done for veterans. I can't get the time of day. I sent her back a response that I'm a veteran too. But like the sheriff's department said, when I asked them for some assistance on something, you're the wrong color to expect help from us. Now, the person that you've got the problem with is Hispanic, so we're not going to do anything. It was an assault caught on video. And when I pushed it, wouldn't you know the video evidence vanished? They had no idea what happened to it. Without that, of course, they couldn't do anything because he was a wonderful person. Well, it's not justice when you have to be a certain race or a certain color or a certain this or a certain that to get assistance. Unfortunately, that's how our society has gone. Well, as I said, today's November 11th, 315th day of the year. Leap year is 316th. 50 days remain till this year is over with. Well, on this date in history, in the year 308, at Carnuntum, Emperor Emeritus Diocletian confers with Galerius, Augustus of the East, and Maximianus, the recently returned former Augustus of the West, in an attempt to end the civil wars of the Tetrarchy. They used to have three rulers who ruled kind of as a committee. In the year 1028, Constantine VIII died, ending his uninterrupted reign as emperor or co-emperor of the Byzantine Empire. He had ruled for 66 years. 1100, Henry I of England marries Matilda of Scotland. She was the daughter of Malcolm III of Scotland and a direct descendant of the Saxon king Edmund Ironside. She's crowned on the same day as the wedding. 1215, the Fourth Council of the Lateran meets. They define the doctrine of transubstantiation. Now, that was the process by which the bread and wine used in the Mass are said to transform into the body and blood of Christ. Got to have a good imagination. So in order to make sure everybody had the same imagination, they defined the doctrine of transubstantiation. Year 1500, Treaty of Granada. Louis XII of France and Ferdinand II of Aragon agree to divide the Kingdom of Naples between them. 1572, Tycho Brahe observes the supernova SN 1572. 1620, the Mayflower Compact is signed in what's now Provincetown Harbor near Cape Cod. Now, for those that are not familiar with the Mayflower Compact, that was the first governing document of the Plymouth Colony. It was originally titled The Agreement Between the Settlers of New Plymouth, written by the male passengers of the Mayflower, consisting of separatist Puritans, adventurers, and tradesmen. It was signed aboard ship on November 21st, which is actually, by today's calendar, be November 11th. Signing of the covenant were 41 of the ship's 101 passengers. Now, this is why the Mayflower was anchored in Provincetown Harbor within the hook at the southern tip of the Cape Cod. Now, the pilgrims had originally hoped to reach America in early October using two ships, but delays and complications meant they could only use one, and that was the Mayflower, which was financed by my ancestors. I don't think they ever got repaid. Their intended destination had been the colony of Virginia, with the journey financed by the Company of Merchant Adventurers of London, which was a lot of money for my ancestors. Storms forced them to anchor at the hook of Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and as provisions were running short, it was decided it wasn't wise to continue. This inspired some of the non-Puritan passengers, who the Puritans called strangers, to proclaim they would use their own liberty, for none had power to command them, since they wouldn't be settling in the agreed-upon Virginia territory. To prevent this from happening, the Pilgrims determined to establish their own government while still affirming their allegiance to the crown. So basically, the Mayflower Compact was the Puritans telling everybody, this is how it's going to be. 1634, following pressure from Anglican Vicar John Atherton, the Irish House of Commons passed an act for the punishment of the vice of buggery. This day, in time, it's called sodomy. 1673, second battle of Kontian in Ukraine. Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth forces under the command of Jan Sobieski defeat the Ottoman army. In this battle, rockets made by Kazimierz Semenov, the which are successfully used. We always come up with new ways to kill folks. 1675, Gottfried Leibniz demonstrates integral calculus for the first time to find the area under the graph of y equals f, parentheses x. 1724, Joseph Blake, alias Blueskin, a Highlander known for attacking thief-taker general and thief Jonathan Wild at the Old Bailey, is hung in London. 1750, riots break out in Lhasa after the murder of the Tibetan regent. When in doubt, take to the streets. 1750, the FHC Society, known as the Flat Hat Club, is formed in Raleigh Tavern, Williamsburg, Virginia. It is the very first college fraternity of which we have record. 1778, Cherry Valley Massacre. Loyalists and Seneca Indian forces attack a fort and a village in eastern New York during the American Revolution. Kill more than 40 civilians and soldiers. 1805, Napoleonic Wars, Battle of Durenstein. 8,000 French troops attempt to slow the retreat of a vastly superior Russian and Austrian force. 1813, War of 1812, Battle of Chrysler's Farm. British Canadian forces defeat a larger American force, causing the Americans to abandon their St. Lawrence campaign. 1831, in Jerusalem, Virginia, Nat Turner is hung after inciting a very violent slave uprising. 1839, Virginia Military Institutes founded in Lexington, Virginia. 1865, Treaty of Tsingtula is signed, where Bhutan cedes the areas east of the Tsetse River to the British East Indian Company. 1869, Victorian Aboriginal Protection Act is enacted in Australia. That gives the government control of Indigenous people's wages, their terms of employment, where they could live, and the lives of their children, effectively leading to what's called the Stolen Generations. 1880, Australian bushranger Ned Kelly is hung at Melbourne Goal. 1887, August Spies, Albert Parsons, Adolf Fisher, and George Engel are executed as a result of the Haymarket Affair. Now, the Haymarket Affair was interesting, also known as the Haymarket Massacre, Haymarket Riot, or the Haymarket Square Riot. Aftermath of a bombing took place at a labor demonstration May 4, 1886 at the Haymarket Square in Chicago. Began peacefully enough in support of the workers striking for an 8-hour workday. The day after, police killed one and injured several workers. An unknown person threw a dynamite bomb at the police as they acted to disperse the meeting, and the bomb blast and ensuing gunfire resulted in the deaths of 7 police officers and 4 civilians. Dozens of others were wounded. In internationally publicized legal proceedings that followed, 8 anarchists were convicted of conspiracy. Evidence was that one of the defendants may have built the bomb, but none of those on trial had thrown it. 7 were sentenced to death and 1 to a term of 15 years in prison. Illinois Governor Richard Oglesby commuted 2 of the sentences to terms of life in prison. Another committed suicide in jail rather than face the gallows. The other 4 were hung November 11, 1887. 1893, Illinois Governor John Peter Altgeld pardoned the remaining defendants and criticized the trial. The Haymarket Affair is generally considered significant as the origin of International Workers' Day, which is held on May 1st. Also, the climax of the social unrest among the working class in America known as the Great Upheaval. That site of that incident was designated Chicago Landmark in 1992. Now, 1889, the state of Washington is admitted as the 42nd state of the United States. 1911, many cities in the Midwestern United States break their record highs and lows on the same day as a strong cold front moves in. 1918, World War I, Germany signs an armistice agreement with the Allies in a railroad car in the forest of Compiègne. 1918, Joseph Piłsudski assumes supreme military power in Poland. Symbolic first day of Polish independence. 1918, Emperor Charles I of Austria gives up his power. See, Austria was actually the, began World War I as a result of the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and his wife. (Clears throat) 1919, industrial workers of the world attack an Armistice Day parade in Centralia, Washington. 5 people die as a result of the uprising. 1919, Latvian forces defeat the West Russian Volunteer Army at Riga in the Latvian War of Independence. 1921, the Tomb of the Unknowns is dedicated by President Harding at Arlington National Cemetery. 1923, Adolf Hitler was arrested in Munich for high treason for his role in the Beer Hall Putsch. That was the initial coup attempt by the Nazis. 1926, the United States numbered highway system is established. 1930, patent number US-178-1541 is awarded to Albert Einstein and Leo Szilard for their invention, the Einstein refrigerator. Now, for those not familiar with that, it's an absorption refrigerator that has no moving parts, operates at a constant pressure, and requires only a heat source to operate. It was jointly invented in 26 by Albert Einstein and a former student who... it's a development of the original three-fluid patent by the Swedish inventors Balthasar von Platen and Karl Munters. It was just an attempt to improve home refrigeration technology. 1934, the Shrine of Remembrance is opened in Melbourne, Australia. 1940, in the Battle of Taranto, the Royal Navy launches the first all-aircraft ship-to-ship naval attack in history. Then also in 1940, the German auxiliary cruiser Atlantis captures top-secret British mail from the Ultimatum and sends it to Japan. 1942, France's Zone Libre is occupied by German forces in Caix-Anton. 1960, military coup against President Diem of South Vietnam is crushed. 1961, 13 Italian Air Force servicemen deployed to the Congo as part of the UN peacekeeping force are massacred by a mob in Kindu. 1962, Kuwait's National Assembly ratifies the Constitution of Kuwait. 1965, Southern Rhodesia's Prime Minister Ian Smith unilaterally declares the colony independent as the unrecognized state of Rhodesia. 1966, NASA launches Gemini 12. 1967, Vietnam War and a propaganda ceremony in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Three American prisoners of war are released by the Viet Cong and turned over to the New Left anti-war activist Tom Hayden, who at the time was Jane Fonda's husband. Hanoi Jane, as they called her. 1968, Operation Commando Hunt initiated. The goal is to interdict men and supplies on the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos into South Vietnam. 1972, Vietnamization. The U.S. Army turns over the massive Long Binh military base to South Vietnam. 1975, Australian constitutional crisis of 75. Australian Governor General Sir John Kerr dismisses the government of Whitlam, appoints Malcolm Fraser as caretaker prime minister, announces a general election to be held in early December. 1975, the independence of Angola. 1977, a munitions explosion at a train station in Erie, South Korea kills at least 56 people. 1981, Antigua and Barbuda join the United Nations. 1992, the General Synod of the Church of England votes to allow women to become priests. 1993, a sculpture honoring women who served in the Vietnam War is dedicated at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. 1999, the House of Lords Act is given royal assent, restricting membership of the British House of Lords by virtue of a hereditary peerage. In other words, if your ancestors were members of the peerage, so were you. 2000, the Kemp Run disaster. 155 skiers and snowboarders die when a cable car catches fire in an alpine tunnel in Kemp Run, Austria. 2001, journalist Pierre Bialod, Johan Sutton, and Volker Hendlich are killed in Afghanistan during an attack on the convoy they're traveling in. 2004, New Zealand Tomb of the Unknown Warriors dedicated at the National War Memorial in Wellington. 2004, Palestinian Liberation Organization confirms the death of Yasser Arafat from unidentified causes. Mahmoud Abbas is elected chairman of the PLO minutes later. 2006, Queen Elizabeth II unveils the New Zealand War Memorial in London, commemorating the loss of soldiers from the New Zealand Army and the British Army. 2012, a strong earthquake with a magnitude 6.8 hits northern Burma, kills at least 26 people. 2014, 58 people killed in a bus crash in the Sukhur district in southern Pakistan, Sindh province. Well, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. It's amazing just how many there are, but I'm not going to go through them. Holidays and observances. Birthday of King Genghis Singye Wangchuck in Bhutan. Children's Day in Croatia. Christian Feast Day, Bartholomew of Grottaferrata, Martin of Tours in Roman Catholic Church, Minas, Mercurius in the Coptic Church, Soren Kierkegaard in the Lutheran Church, Theodore the Studite, World War I related observances, Armistice Day in New Zealand, France, Belgium, and Serbia, National Independence Day in Poland, Remembrance Day in the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth of Nations, including Australia and Canada. Veterans Day, called Armistice Day until 1954, and was rededicated to honor American military. In the U.S., Independence Day celebrates independence of Angola from Portugal in 1975. Independence of Cartagena in Colombia. Lactalis Day celebrates the victory over the Promotheans at the Battle of Riga in 1919 in Latvia. Opening of Carnival, in Germany, the Netherlands, and other countries. National Education Day in India. Pepero Day in South Korea. Pakin Pretz Day in Japan. Republic Day in the Maldives. Singles Day in China. St. Martin's Day in St. Martin, Kingdom of the Netherlands. And Women's Day in Belgium. Well, that's it for our histories. We were talking about the lost ship of Noah. You know, many of the historic references to sightings of a ship on Mount Ararat or as seen from the ground have been made by observers visiting cities that have a view of the mountains. And a number of other sightings have been recorded by travelers who move slowly across the Anatolian plain in caravans as they journeyed to and from Persia, Armenia, and the Tatar lands to the north, which are now part of the USSR. In ancient and medieval times, when faith was stronger, men less skeptical, the presence of Noah's Ark on Ararat was generally accepted as a fact. Therefore, as travelers passed by the mountains, their guides would customarily point out places on the slopes of the summit where Noah's Ark might still be seen. And in the clear light of the early morning before the cloud cover the summit, or in the dusk when the clouds have gone and the black shape of the crest appear against the rose-colored sky in early evening, it becomes easier for a believer, or even an imaginative non-believer, to see the outline of a great ship on the heights. And although there exists a great number of references to the Ark in ancient or medieval times, some of them refer to particulars which later became familiar to modern searches for the Ark. Berosus, a Babylonian historian who wrote in 275 BC, referred to the ship that grounded in Armenia and mentioned the custom of local residents who obtained pitch from the ship by scraping it off and using it for amulets. Now, this same curious piece of information intrigued the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, writing in the first century during the Roman occupation of Judea. In retelling the story of Noah and the flood, Josephus wrote, a portion of the vessel still survives in Armenia. People carry off pieces of the bitumen, which they use as talismans. A tradition in the late Middle Ages recommended that pitch be ground into powder and dissolved into a beverage to be drunk to preserve he who drank it from poison. Well, it's thought that references to pitch and bitumen by these and other ancient writers are of interest, not only because they're in agreement with Genesis, but also because they indicate access to that ship in the intervening centuries, and they offer an explanation as to why some work beams and timbers found high on the mountains under the ice may have been well preserved. Flavius Josephus included an interesting note in his History of the Jews. He said Armenia is called the place of descent for the Ark being saved, and that place, its remains are shown there by the inhabitants to this day. Now, Nicholas of Damascus, who wrote Universal History in the 1st century A.D., refers to Mount Ararat as Baris. He said, there in Armenia is a great mountain called Baris, where many refugees found safety in the time of the flood, and one man, transported on an ark, grounded on the summit, and relics of the timbers are long preserved. Now, Baris was another name for the present Mount Ararat, which in Armenia is referred to as Masis, the mother of the world. Nicholas of Nicodemus exhibits a somewhat scholarly reticence to jumping to conclusions when he adds it might be the same man of which Moses, the Jewish legislator, wrote. Now, one of the most famous travelers of history passed by Ararat in the last part of the 15th century. This is Marco Polo on his way to the court of the great Khan in Cathay. In his book, The Travels of Marco Polo, he made an intriguing reference to the Ark. He wrote, you must know that it's in this country of Armenia that the Ark of Noah exists on top of a certain great mountain on the summit of which snow is so constant nobody can ascend. That snow never melts and it's constantly added to by new snowfalls. Below, however, the snow does melt and run down, producing such rich and abundant herbage that in summer cattle are sent to pasture from a long roundabout way and it never fails them. Well, Marco Polo's description still fits Mount Ararat, except for the statement nobody can ascend it. The important point that the snow and ice melts on the bottom and runs under the glaciers is especially noteworthy since it's been in certain crevices under the glaciers that modern investigators have found ancient handwork, beams, and timbers. And since nobody built a house up there that anybody knows about, it would seem logical we're talking about remnants of the Ark, or at least a great ship. A German visitor to the area in the early 17th century, Adam Olslager, observed in his book Voyages and Travels of the Ambassador, the Armenians and Persians themselves are of the opinion there are still, on the said mountain, some remainders of the Ark, but that time has so hardened them that they seem to be absolutely petrified. Now, Well, Slogger mentions of the putrefaction of the timbers fits in with actual timbers brought back from the treeless glacial slopes of the mountain, which now can be seen in the monastery of Akmatizan, and which also resemble pieces of the alleged ark brought back in modern times by the French explorer and mountaineer Ferdinand Navarra, and further remains discovered by other explorers. They're bringing down petrified wood. Sir John Mandeville saw the mountain in 1356, and dazzled by its sheer height, most apparent in the early morning before the clouds hide the summit, was one of the first observers to attempt the estimate of its height. He describes a mountain called Ararat, where Noah's ship rested, and still is upon that mountain, and man can see it afar in clear weather. He said that mountain is a full 7 miles high. It's actually 17,011 feet high. This type of overenthusiasm on the part of Sir John tends to minimize his other observations of Mount Ararat. It's understandable, however, when one takes into account Ararat's sudden and awe-inspiring appearance when the clouds lift. Dr. John Montgomery, in a book, The Quest for Noah's Ark, suggests that Mandeville may have been calculating the distance from the foothills to the top of the peak, which is almost 7 miles. The many writers of antiquity in the Middle Ages who have described Ararat apparently don't feel called upon to attempt to climb up its sides, face its glaciers, precipices, rock slides, and avalanches to find out firsthand whether or not the ark is still there. In their day, it wasn't really necessary. Religious faith before the era of doubt, which initiated the modern age, needed no reaffirmation, and in addition, there was always the threat of divine interdiction against profaning what they referred to as the holy vessel. The Christian population of Europe and the Middle East from the days of the Byzantine Empire firmly believed the Ark was on Mount Ararat, and the later teachings of Islam reinforced that belief in the Flood, the Ark, and Noah. And that the ark would only be revealed by God on the day of judgment. Franciscan friar by the name of Oderic, who was later to report back to the papal court in Avignon, saw the mountain in 1316 and related that folks in the country told us, "Nobody could ever ascend the mountain, for this hath seemed not to be the pleasure of the Most High." Oderic himself, alone among ancient or medieval commentators, was seemingly unimpressed by the sheer height of the mountain. More than 400 years before the first recorded ascent, he wrote, I would fain have ascended if my companions would have waited for me, but they refused. Belief in the ark was then, and often is now, an article of faith. Some Byzantine churchmen referring to the ark as a standing proof of the church teachings. John Chrysostom, a 4th century patriarch of Constantinople, asked questions to which he thought the answers were amply evident. Let us therefore ask they who do not believe, have you heard of the flood, that universal destruction? That wasn't just a threat, was it? Did it not really come to pass? Was not this mighty work carried out? And are not the remains of the ark preserved there to this day for our admonition? In like fashion, Bishop Epiphanius of Salamis asked, do you seriously suppose we're unable to prove our point, when even to this day the remains of Noah's Ark are shown in the country of the Kurds? Now, this 4th century reference to the Kurds suggests that they were already established around the mountain along with the Armenians at a very early date. The Armenians are gone now, mainly concentrated in the Armenian SSR of the USSR and in communities within the USA. The Kurds still live in the Mount Ararat area and from time to time engage in raids and warfare against local governments in Kurdish-populated areas in the Middle East. With a legend about God's prohibition against man's ascending Mount Ararat has lasted until fairly modern times. Dr. Friedrich Parrot, a German professor of natural philosophy from Dorpat University in Estonia, then part of Imperial Russia, made the first official climb to the summit in 1829, gave his name to the Parrot Glacier, which flows northwest down the mountain. Parrot observed of his Russian and Armenian climbing companions, are all firmly persuaded that the ark remains to this day on top of Mount Ararat. And in order to ensure its preservation, no human being is allowed to approach it. Previous to his climb, Parrot spent some time in St. Jacob's Monastery in Aurora on the northwest side of the mountain, was shown by the abbot some wood that supposedly came from the ark, which had been made into an icon. But the monastery, monks, and village of Aurora disappeared in 1840 during Mount Ararat's last volcanic eruption. It buried the monastery and the village and left a precipitous gorge where the buildings had once stood. Dr. Hermann Abick, another German professor in mineralogy, also from the University of Dorpat, climbed Ararat in 1845. Now, Abick's name has been immortalized in the two Abick glaciers, one of which Norz Liept emptied its waters into the Aurora Gorge on the northeast side of the mountain that looks toward Russia. And although he wasn't specifically looking for the Ark, one of his reasons for climbing the mountain was a curious one, suggested by Spassky Avtonomov, another of the early climbers. They both wanted to ascertain whether the stars and planets are visible during the day from extremely high mountaintops. Prior to the modern investigations, which started in the 1820s, there have been a number of hearsay or legendary accounts of ascents to the upper regions of Ararat and a number of sightings or touchings of the Ark. These accounts concern visits to the Ark by holy men looking for sacred relics, herders searching for lost animals from their flocks, or collectors of wood or pitch from the ship at a time when the Ark was presumably accessible, as it possibly was before the last earthquake and eruption of Mount Ararat in 1840. Now, these have been variously considered either as miracles or unusual exploits. In one case, a shepherd told of finding a great cliff on the heights while he was searching for lost sheep. As he came closer to that cliff, it turned out to be the side of an enormous ship, partially covered by ice and snow. Well, he fled in fear of punishment for his sacrilege by getting close to what he referred to as God's holy ship. But in former times as now, shepherds have tended to avoid the extreme heights as a place for sickness and death, not realizing the sickness is simply the mountain sickness induced by altitude. They recognized the danger point. The danger zone is the point where the sheep began to die and feel uncomfortably they have gone far enough. According to tradition, one Byzantine prelate attempted to climb to the Ark. This was a monk, Jacob of Mesbin, later Bishop of Nisibis, and finally a saint. After a long series of prayers to God he'd be allowed to see the Ark, he started a long climb up the west side of Mount Ararat. Tormented by thirst and overcome by fatigue, he lay down to rest. When he awoke, he found that a spring had miraculously appeared near where he had rested. That spring, which is now called Jacob's Well, is still there and serves as a landmark on the mountain. Later on, he continued his climb, but after each rest, he'd find upon waking his once again at the point where he'd started. Presumably, he'd been carried down by the angels. But God finally granted his prayers and sent an angel to visit him. The angel told Jacob to cease his attempts to climb the forbidden mountain and gave him a piece of the ark. The angel then informed Jacob that the ark was forbidden territory for mankind until such time as God himself should choose to reveal it. Sir John Chardon, an early observer of Mount Ararat, and commenting on this miracle in 1356, observed, instead of it being a miracle that nobody could ever reach the top, I'd rather deem it a great miracle that anybody did reach its top. From its halfway point to the peak, it's perpetually covered by snow, so that at all seasons it has the appearance of a vast snow heap. A British ascent was made to the top of Mount Ararat in 1856 by a group led by a veteran of the Crimean War, Major Robert Stewart. During his climb, he found his Kurdish guides came to a halt at a certain place and refused to go any further. Alleging in justification ancestral tradition and the fear of treading on holy ground, and said that the scale of the mountain is impossible and any attempt of this kind will be followed by the immediate displeasure of heaven. Well, when several members of the British party reached the summit, some among the reluctant Kurds, as reported by Major Stewart, exclaimed, "We'd always thought that Allah had made that holy mountain inaccessible to man. Many have tried to ascend it, but nobody ever succeeded till you came, and without any preparation, you walk straight up from the base to the top. Allah be praised. We've heard strange things of you, but now we see them with our own eyes." Major apparently accepted this accolade with British aplomb and reported it in an entry worthy of the best traditions in the empire. He said, "Then indeed they began to feel the force of which we asserted, that many things forbidden to the Kurds were allowed to the English." Well, maybe so. The northeastern part of Turkey is a frequent scene of earthquakes and has been so thoroughly recorded throughout history. An especially violent earthquake occurred in June of 1840. It completely demolished the town of Agoura, also known as Aurora, located on the northeastern side of Ararat. The earthquake and eruption of Mount Ararat killed all of Aurora's inhabitants and also destroyed the Armenian monastery of St. Jacob, the one visited by Parrott and other travelers that was reputed to contain a number of ancient records pertaining to the Ark, as well as pieces of the Ark itself. That event left a deep gorge at the melting end of the Black Glacier, so-called because of the covering of black dust coming from the crushed, shattered rocks. This drop-off, which is almost 800 feet of sheer cliff, is called the Aurora Gorge. At the bottom of the gorge, water collects from the seasonally melting bottom of the 600-foot-thick glacier directly above the gorge. It seemed normal to suppose that if the Ark had really survived thousands of years on the mountain, it would have either been exposed by the above-mentioned seismic disaster or been itself completely demolished. But
motion detected at the front door.
Subterranean, submarine, or subglacial results of an earthquake are rarely predictable, and a reported discovery of the Ark by Turkish authorities wasn't made public till the summer of 1883, when a new earthquake had shaken the mountain and demolished a number of villages. The Turkish commissioners, including an attaché of the British Embassy in Istanbul, which was then called Constantinople, were assessing the damage and changes when they reported they came upon a huge wooden boat-like structure. It's painted brown, made of heavy timber, some of which were broken, and the end of it emerged from the bottom of an overhanging glacier. The commissioners estimated the height of that object to be 50 feet. Its length, the equivalent of 300 cubits, reported that it actually entered that ship-like structure. They were able to penetrate three large compartments, but the other sections were filled with solid ice. After reassessing their situation, they prudently decided to abandon the investigation of their find because of the possibility that a huge glacial overhang might collapse on the ship and on them as well. This report concerning the Ark first appeared in the press of Constantinople, and after that in the Levant Herald and the British Prophetic Messenger. But instead of awakening scientific or archaeological interest in the Ark legend, it furnished the American press with an item ready-made for its kind of reporting, preserved for UFO stories. The New York Herald noted that since a British officer among the discoverers, the height of the stalls on board the presumed vessel was in accord with the specifications of the British Admiralty for horse transport, and therefore not open to doubt. As for the length of the craft, 300 cubits, a nation that has seriously thought of a ship railway across Central America cannot doubt that the Ark can be brought to deep water. Adding that when such a thing happened and the Ark reaches American waters, the Navy Department ought to purchase her at once, because the world's greatest republic ought to have at least one ship that won't rot as soon as it leaves the Navy Yard, which was a kind of a dig at the Department of the Navy. Article in the Chicago Tribune reported that the inhabitants in the vicinity of Ararat had noted a great structure of dark wood for a number of years, but had been afraid to go near it. They said a spirit of fierce aspect had been seen looking out the window. The official party, it stated, had recognized the Ark immediately, since there was an Englishman among them who had presumably read his Bible, and he saw that it was made of the ancient gopher wood of Scripture. Now, unfortunately, gopher wood is still not satisfactorily identified. We don't really know what gopher wood is. Feature writer of the New York World changed the nationality of the exploring party to Russians and then compared the finding of the Ark to the famous Cardiff Giant hoax. He added the reader shouldn't be surprised if he learns from the latest dispatches from our representative, Mr. Benjamin, that the engineers have broken through the third compartment of the Ark and, in a true spirit of the age, have discovered the original log kept by Noah and his sons. I doubt Noah and his sons kept a log. As in the case of today's press reporting of UFO sightings, no follow-ups appeared in the newspapers, and the entire incident was more or less forgotten, except for the reader's impression that something of a hoax had been perpetrated. It was in this atmosphere that another series of curious incidents took place, only 4 years after the reported post-earthquake discovery. This time it concerned a report made to the World Parliament of Religions meeting in Chicago in 1893 by John Joseph, Prince of Nuri, who held among numerous other titles that of Archbishop and Grand Apostolic Ambassador of Malabar, India, and Persia. Prince Nuri stated at the meeting he had reached the Ark during his explorations in 1887 to ascertain the source of the Euphrates. He claimed to have tried to climb Mount Ararat three times, succeeding on a third attempt. He described the ark as being more than 100 feet high and 300 yards long, with one end broken off. Following the considerable publicity caused by his statements, he undertook to organize an expedition to Ararat and to lead it up to the point where the ark was lying, and then to disassemble the ark for easy transportation and reassemble it for exhibition at the then current Chicago's World Fair. Well, to this end, he successfully involved a group of investors, but the enterprise was halted practically at its inception since the Turkish permission for the undertaking was denied. Well, Prince Nuri's career further complicated by his being mugged while on a trip to San Francisco and a resultant stay in a mental hospital came to an untimely end in the early 1900s. That left unresolved further verification of his discovery of the Ark. The difficulty of proving the existence of a ship on or near the summit of Ararat's been compounded by the lack of photographs and contemporaneous corroboration from other witnesses. A number of reports of individual visits to the Ark in the 19th century didn't surface till after the second decade of the 20th century, and when a striking event concerning the Ark occurred during World War I. A variety of contemporary and corroborative reports of this incident and its subsequent ramifications are still circulating, and even now new information from secondary witnesses is still being received, although the number of witnesses become fewer each passing year. You know, an unusual sighting of the Ark, maybe the most celebrated, allegedly occurred in the summer of 1916 during the thaw. It was made by Lieutenant Ruskovitsky and his co-pilot while flying an observation airplane of the Russian Imperial Air Force. Their orders were to accomplish high-altitude tests and to observe Turkish troop movements during a time when the Russian armies were being hard-pressed on several fronts. Their small air base was located about 25 miles northeast of Mount Ararat. Ruskovitsky and his co-pilot, equipped with oxygen tanks for high-altitude breathing, approached Mount Ararat from the northeast, circled it twice, and as it got closer, Ruskovitsky noticed a half-frozen lake on a shelf or gully on the side of the mountain, similar to those glacial concentrations which increase or decrease in size according to seasonal glacial melting. As they flew nearer, the co-pilot pointed to something near the lake's overflow, and Ruskovitsky realized he was looking at what appeared to be a half-submerged hull of some sort of huge ship. First, he thought it might be a submarine, attributing it to the Germans, masters of submarine warfare, the ability to launch a submarine within a lake well up the side of a massive mountain. He then noticed that what he first took for periscopes were two stubby masts, and the ship, which it apparently was, leaning to one side into the ice. He also saw a flat catwalk down the length of the top of the ship. Well, Ruskovitsky's words, reported from New Eden magazine in California in 1939, said, "We flew as close as safely permitted and took several circles around it. We were surprised when we got close to it at the immense size of the thing. It was as long as a city block when compared very favorably in size to the modern battleships of today. It was grounded on the shore of the lake, with one-fourth of it underwater. It had been partly dismantled on one side near the front, and on the other side there was a great doorway nearly 20 feet square, but with the other door gone. Now, this seemed quite out of proportion, as even today ships seldom have doors even half that size." And after this somewhat cursory examination, Ruskovitsky returned to his base and informed the base commander, who was a captain, of what he'd seen. The captain, understandably impressed, told Ruskovitsky to take him back to the site and told him, after seeing it, that what he had flown over was Noah's Ark. He explained its survival by the supposition it was frozen up the 9 or 10 months of the year. It couldn't rot and had been in cold storage, as it were, all this time. Well, the captain forwarded a report back to St. Petersburg with the result that orders came from the Tsar to send two engineer companies up the mountain. One group of 50 men attacked one side, and the other group of 100 men attacked the big mountain from the other side. 2 weeks of hard work were required to chop out a trail along the cliffs of the lower part of the mountain. It was nearly a month before the Ark was reached. Now, that the imperial government, by order of the Tsar, would send specialized troops to climb up Mount Ararat during a time when they were needed elsewhere raises the possibility of a psychological operation planned to give the Russian army and people a spiritual uplift, and indications of divine protection in the dark days prior to the February revolution that overthrew the Tsar. Germans previously attempted religio-psychological operations, including powerful airborne magic lanterns projecting onto the cloud banks over the Russian lines, pictures of the Holy Family and the Russian saints who seemed to hover protectively over the German trenches. Certainly such a thing was possible, but since it was found literally by accident, I tend to doubt it was a German psychological operation. Complete measurements were taken and plans drawn, as well as many photographs taken, all of which were sent to the Tsar. According to the magazine article, the Ark was found to contain hundreds of small rooms and some rooms that were very large with high ceilings. The unusually large rooms had a fence of great timbers across them, some of which were at least 2 feet thick, as it was designed to hold beasts 10 times the size of elephants. Other rooms were also lined with tiers of cages, somewhat like you see today at a poultry show. And instead of chicken wire, there were rows of small iron bars along the front. Now, the writer of the article, while mentioning beasts 10 times as large as elephants, tends to destroy his credibility. If, on the other hand, the Roscovitsky story, written long after the events, a compendium of a variety of witnesses, pilots, soldiers, engineers, and whoever, it's understandable exaggerations could occur. At the same time, we don't know what species of animals may have died in the ensuing time between the time of Noah's Ark and now. Everything is heavily painted with a wax-like paint resembling shellac, and the workmanship of the craft showed signs of a high type of civilization. The word used throughout was oleander, which belongs to the cypress family and never rots. And, of course, that coupled with the fact it's been frozen most of the time accounted for its perfect preservation, according to the best guesses of the engineers. Now, these descriptions seem so close to the biblical description that André Perret, a French writer on the Ark and the Flood, dismissed Roscovitsky's whole account with, "It's unfortunate that no competent person saw the report," which was lost during the course of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. All we have is Roscovitsky's story, of which the least that can be said is if it was shorn of reminiscences of Genesis, scarce anything is left. And that didn't prevent several American periodicals from proclaiming the sensational news. Serious specialized organs preserved for it the fate it deserved, which was silence. If St. Peter came down today and set up shop in Times Square, a number of so-called news organs would deny he was there. So you can't... And André Perret, like many scientists who, when faced with unexplained events, wasn't there himself. He just didn't believe it. The expedition found on the peak of the mountain above the ship the remains of the timbers that were missing out of one side of the ship. It seemed that these timbers had been hauled up to the top of the peak and used to build a tiny shrine. Now, this mention of a shrine is an especially intriguing feature of the Roscovitsky account in that it seems to explain why separate timbers have been found at different points on the highest points of the mountain, thousands of feet above the tree line. If during the thousands of years the ship had lain on the mountain and been visited by occasional pilgrims at a time when it was more visible, more accessible, some of them would probably have constructed a shrine nearer at the summit made out of the Ark's wood. This would be in remembrance, perhaps, of the traditional altar said to have been built by Noah after the flood when he gave thanks for their survival. Roscovitsky's published account breaks off rather abruptly, simply stating the investigative officer sent photographs and reports by courier back to Petrograd to the personal attention of the Tsar. But Nicholas II apparently never received them during the breakdown of communications that followed the February and October revolutions of 1917. The results of the investigation have never been found. Never been reported. A rumor exists the results of the investigation pictures of the Ark came to the attention of Leon Trotsky, who either destroyed him or put him in a file destined to be kept permanently secret. After all, it was Trotsky and Lenin's firm belief that God didn't exist. Therefore, there couldn't have been a flood, and there couldn't have been the Ark, and there couldn't have been a Noah. According to the same rumor, the special courier's silence on the matter is also permanently secured by his own execution. Roscovitsky's account ends with a simple statement. He and several other pilots escaped the Bolshevik revolution by going to Armenia and eventually to America. An enigma and stumbling block in the acceptance of this much-published report, though, lies in the identity of Roscovitsky. No known survivor of the Imperial Army or Air Force in the Ararat era at that time remembers any Lieutenant Roscovitsky. This would seem to indicate he never existed, or that at the time that he wrote the magazine article, even though it was 22 years after the discovery of the Ark, he was unwilling to use his own name for reasons of self-protection, even in America. Nevertheless, there's been considerable recollection among individual Russian Army survivors who were involved in operations during that period and in that locale. Earl Cummings, an outstanding researcher at the Ark Legend for more than 40 years and veteran of 25 ascents of Ararat, was able to make personal contact with Colonel Alexander Kure, author of an article about the incident printed in 1945 in Razia, an overseas Russia magazine in New York. Colonel Kure was been in command of the 19th Petropavlovsky Regiment stationed near Mount Ararat in 1915 and 1916. They had the mission of protecting the Aratsky Pass at a time the Turkish forces made a partial breakthrough in the Russian lines. He remembered having heard of the reputed finding of the Ark and gave pertinent information in a certified interview with Ark researcher Cummings. Colonel Kure stated it was his opinion that the pilot who saw the Ark was First Lieutenant Zabolotsky, and the captain's name, not given in the original article, was Kurbatov. Zabolotsky, according to Colonel Kure, sighted the Ark and started the investigation. Kure had spoken to a Lieutenant Pyotr Leslin in 1921 who informed him that he, Leslin, had heard about the discovery, not as a rumor, but as news told to him by a senior adjutant in his division, and that Noah's Ark was found in the saddle of the two peaks of Ararat. Now, Kure also supplied information about the latter visit to the Ark by the engineer battalion when he received from Boris Rujansky, family friend who in 1916 and 1917 was a sergeant of the military railroad battalion, which was then stationed near Dolgobayadzhet, located several miles from Mount Ararat, and through which the railroad formerly passed. Sergeant Lujansky had actually taken part in the investigation and corroborated the ascent of the battalion to the heights of Mount Ararat. Now, the Kure account was more complete than the Roscovitsky article in that it specified that one of the two investigative expeditions had climbed Ararat by following an existing trail. At one point, they found that their climb had led them to a place where they were looking down on the huge ship, which had one end underwater. The other end, which arrived there first, the other unit, which arrived there first, didn't follow the trail, but had to cut steps in the ice as they climbed. When this unit reached the ship, a number of the soldiers crossed themselves, some falling to their knees in prayer before entering it. Inside the Ark, according to the Kure article, there were partitions. It appeared there were also rust marks on the floor, presumably from the iron rods that marked the rusted iron bars into many small and very large partitions. Despite persistent efforts by Cummings, Dr. John Montgomery, who also interviewed Colonel Kure in 1917, and others, the official reports and photographs referred to in several versions of the 1916 discovery of the Ark have never surfaced to public view. But a number of interviews and statements have, according to separate testimonies of individual Russian soldiers who, during a maneuver around Mount Ararat in the summer of 1917, remember seeing a wooden structure shaped like a ship several hundred feet above them as they marched by. Soldiers noticed that one end of that object they saw went back into the snow and ice of the mountain.
Motion detected at the front door.
Now, there have been reports of a number of conversations with refugee Russian officers in Paris in the mid-20s. Officers left the Caucasus area with refugees from the armies of General Denikin, one of the last generals held out against the communists until there was no hope but retreat over the border and escape. Several of those officers have been active in Turkey and still remember hearing a report about the finding of the Ark on Mount Ararat. Story had been told through the army on the southern front, but was overshadowed by the fall of the dynasty and the disintegration of the imperial armies. There was another unusual legend current among Russian officers and their families. This was that several members of the imperial family had escaped the massacre at Ekaterinburg in 1918 and had been spirited away through a network of monasteries and convents to safety in other countries. Now, this sort of legend has occurred on various occasions in the stormy history of imperial Russia. Russian history has witnessed a number of pretenders to the throne, false czars and false heirs to the throne. whose putative identity is usually settled by their defeat and execution. It's only natural that such legends have subsisted in regard to the last imperial family and certain survivors, notably Anastasia, the young imperial princess, as well as the Tsarevich. They've been the subject of a number of books published in Great Britain and the U.S. One alleged Tsarevich bearing the same name as the son of the last Tsar, Alexei Nikolaevich Romanov, and considered by a number of people and personally convinced as well, was alive until May 1986 and living in Phoenix, Arizona. Well, I've got some excerpts from a telephone conversation between an author and Alexei Nikolaevich Romanov. It should be remembered that the Mr. Romanov in this telephone call was the same age as Tsarevich would have been had he survived and was in poor health at the time of the interview. First question, do you remember hearing that Noah's Ark was found on Mount Ararat in 1916? He said, I remember hearing talk about the discovery. A ship had been seen near the top of the mountain by aviators. Well, who'd you hear it from? I heard it from my father and people were talking about it in the palace. Do you remember your father, the emperor, saying he'd sent an expedition to the place where the ark was found? He said, yes, something of that sort. My father consulted with the Duma, and I think the Duma made the decision. Army officers had reported it. The army was in Turkey then. I remember my father saying there was an expedition that had been sent. Was that the Russian army in the Caucasus under the command of the Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolaevich? He said, that was my uncle. You know, he's almost 7 feet tall. He used to carry me sometimes. I used to see him in Sarkoye Selo, that's north of Petrograd. I don't remember much. I was very ill at the time. And true, the actual Tsarevich was ill. Now, there were also memories among the Kurds and the Turks. Mustafa, a former herdsman now living in Dogebayazit, and whose present activities are centered in visits to the mosque and tea house, is now over 85 years old. He was interviewed in August of 1985 in order to ascertain if he'd ever heard about the Russian expedition to find the Ark. According to Mustafa, he said, yes, I remember one thing very well. My father was working on the railroad the Russians were repairing. He was asked what people worked in the work teams, and he said the teams had Russian and Turks and Kurds. And he was asked, did the teams hear anything about the Russian expedition? He said, by Allah, one day everybody did. It was in late summer one afternoon. We heard a great noise of shouting and yelling hurrah by the Russians. In the village, we thought it was a battle because the Russians always yell hurrah and attacks. Then his father came running in. Remember, it was early for him to come home. He said there was no battle, but the Russians were drinking bottles of vodka and firing off guns, revolvers, and a machine gun. He said the head of the team said to the workers, don't you know what happened on the mountain? They found the Ark. The team that was sent by the Tsar himself. It's a great day of joy for the Russians. And he was asked, was he surprised? He said, it says, Allah wills. We always thought the Ark was on Agri Dog, but didn't think the Russians would find it. Well, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that the Ark, at least in the early part of the last century, existed. But for today, we've run out of time, so until tomorrow at the same time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.